From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. British voters shocked the world last year with the Brexit vote to leave the European Union. What could that vote mean for North Carolina? We ask the architect of the Vote Leave campaign that promoted Brexit. Some North Carolina state lawmakers want to extend their own terms in office from 2 years to 4 years. You'll hear their arguments. You'll also learn why those arguments fell short, as colleagues raise concerns about the people's power to keep tabs on the General Assembly. Lawmakers are moving forward with a measure to increase protection of free speech on college campuses. You'll learn why. And you'll hear from the author of a new book documenting the growing craft distillery industry in North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Well, it is down to the nitty-gritty detail time for state lawmakers as they negotiate a deal on a new state operating budget. Governor Roy Cooper released his plan earlier this year. Now the North Carolina Senate has released its plan. Becky Gray is the John Locke Foundation's senior vice president, and she says that this Senate budget plan offers more tax relief, it saves more money, and it keeps spending growth in check. She's here to talk about it. Becky, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
The description sounds like fiscal restraint, good stewardship, and we've seen that for a number of years now.
And tax cuts.
There you go.
Yeah.
Actually,
you know, and Donna, that if there's a message with this budget, sort of an overall message, this continues on the prudent, fiscally responsible budgeting that we have seen come out of the General Assembly really since 2011. So this continues us on the path. One of the significant things, just the starting point, was we had $580 million in revenue surplus. That's a big deal. I think it also speaks to the economic growth that these kind of policies being put into place have resulted in. So just the starting point was we're in very good shape in North Carolina, much better than many other states. We're just one of the few states in the country that has a revenue surplus. And this budget continues along those same lines.
You mentioned tax relief. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Senate would further reduce personal income tax. They would further reduce corporate income tax. They would increase the standard deduction, which means that that's that zero tax bracket, the amount of money that you pay no taxes on starting out. It's particularly significant for low-income earners and low-income taxpayers in that they get a break on a significant amount of their initial income right off the bat. Also, some changes in mortgage deduction, changes per child tax credits to deductions, I believe. But, you know, some other things in there that, again, additional tax cuts. As a matter of fact, over a number of years, this would result in $1 billion in tax cuts that North Carolinians get to keep of their own hard-earned money. While at the same time, what this budget does is, I believe that it fully funds, it appropriately funds, it responsibly funds the core functions of government.
It also saves some money, and that's also been a theme the past several years.
And that's also a very important thing to think about. Just if you think of your own family budget, it's important to put that money aside in case your air conditioner breaks this summer or other things come up. We certainly saw this in North Carolina with Hurricane Matthew. Unanticipated, something we didn't expect. We certainly didn't ask for it, but some real needs of our North Carolinians in the eastern part of the state. We had fires in the western part of the state. Luckily, we had money set aside to deal with that, to offer those folks some relief. Didn't have to go back and raise taxes or do any of that. That money was set aside. The General Assembly recognizes the importance of this kind of fiscal responsibility and, again, have set aside additional money into the savings account. As a matter of fact, I believe that the savings reserve now is at the highest point that we've ever seen in state government. It's going to help us get through another hurricane, natural disaster. If we have a downturn in the economy, North Carolina is better positioned than most other states. This is what fiscal responsibility is all about.
And based on that, we know that North Carolina has become a model for other states.
Yes.
Now there's actually some similarities, as our colleague Roy Cordato has pointed out in his piece recently, between the Trump tax plan, that
right.
proposal, and what North Carolina has done. But there's a key issue at play, Becky, and that is you talked about the tax rate reductions that are in the Senate plan and that we've seen previously, but they have also reined in spending.
And that's the two go together. You know, you can't have one without the other. They have set priorities. There are teacher pay increases. There are state employee pay increases. There's money for all kinds of important things, additional money for education going into the classroom, money set aside for Medicaid reserve to make sure that these reforms we've put into place over the next couple of years, there's a little bit of a cushion there for us. Those kind of key functions of government, strategic transportation infrastructure plan, also some attention on that on the budget. So, yeah, I mean, the priorities are there. The money is well spent, but the money is restrained. It's the priorities in this budget are very similar to what the governor's priorities are. The difference is the Senate spends the money better.
Now, what happens next? The House needs to take right. up their budget plan, right?
Yeah, as you mentioned at the beginning of the segment, Donna, we've seen the governor's budget. We now have the Senate budget. The next thing that we'll see is the House budget, and they have already started that process. The House is now looking at it, not starting from ground zero because they have what was in the governor's budget. They've got all the numbers, the fiscal forecasting, those kind of things. Also, some of these really good policies in the Senate budget, we're going to see in the House budget as well. But the House will put their stamp on things, and some of the things we expect to see are perhaps not the $1 billion tax cut, but something more modest. Maybe they're talking $400 million, $600 million, rather than $1 billion, something like that. We haven't seen the plan yet. We expect to see it next week, so we'll see those kind of things. But again, I think we can expect to see teacher pay increases, principal pay increases, something for state employees. Again, funding education, making sure that that money is in the classroom, that it affects kids and opportunities for them, also shoring up the Medicaid. A lot of the things that we've seen in the Senate budget, we will see in the House budget with maybe just a little bit of shifting around of things.
The one dynamic that is different this time around is the person who sits in the governor's seat,
right.
and that is Democrat
right.
Roy Cooper. Of course, it was Republican Pat McCrory in previous years. What role will the governor play in this?
Well, of course, the governor has done his budget proposal, so we see what he would have spent the money. And again, the priorities that the governor laid out, you know, money being spent on education, on infrastructure, tax relief for middle-class families, those kind of things are in the governor's budget. He does have, in North Carolina, the governor has the veto power. So, you know, that's going to be the $22 billion question
right.
in a couple of weeks. After we get the Senate budget, House budget, they will come together, put together a conference report, which is a combination and a compromise of their budgets. It then will go over to the governor's office, and he has a choice of doing three things. Number one, he can sign it into law. He can do nothing, in which fact, after 10 days, it becomes law, or he can veto it. Now, we've seen Governor Cooper has already vetoed a number of bills. He's not shy about vetoing things. We know that. Donna, right now, what I'm seeing so far, and of course, you know, we've just got the solid facts of the Senate budget in front of us right now. We do expect similar things in the House budget. I think this is going to be a tough budget for the governor to veto. But, you know, we'll see. He is already complaining that it doesn't spend enough. Again, you got to go back to that question of what's the revenue? And what's the spending, and how can we find that balance, and how can we appropriately fund things? So, you know, we don't know, but that's what the governor's choice is. He can either sign it into law, he can veto it, or he can do nothing, in which fact then it becomes law by de facto.
Now, Becky, we've talked about some of the tax provisions in the Senate plan, also the issue of saving money and reining in spending growth. What other things are in that Senate budget that you think are really good? Anything to do criminal justice-wise or health care reform,
right.
anything like that?
Thank you for mentioning that. A couple things. One is the Senate budget repeals Certificate of Need. Now, if you're not familiar with that, that's where There is a government slip required for medical equipment, new medical facilities. We've written extensively about this at johnlock.org about the cost and the limiting access that certificate of need laws do. Senate budget completely repeals certificate of need over a number of years. That's very, very good news. It's good policy. It's the smart thing to do. Also, raise the age. Now, this is something, again, we've written a lot about at the John Locke Foundation, lots of information available. This would be where 16 and 17-year-olds would be tried as juveniles rather than as adults.
Becky Gray, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The voters of Great Britain shocked much of the world last year when they voted to exit the European Union. Now, as the details of the Brexit are being worked out, what might it mean for relations between Britain and Europe, between Britain and the U.S.? How about for North Carolina? Well, our next guest has some interesting thoughts on that topic. Matthew Elliott is senior fellow at the Legatum Institute. He was CEO of the Vote Leave campaign that pushed for Brexit. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So obviously, this was something that sent some shockwaves throughout the political world. You, as someone who was pushing for Brexit, I'm guessing you weren't shocked. You saw that there was a ripe opportunity for this to happen, I guess.
I did. And I saw, especially towards the end of the campaign, people realizing that now is the point to go for it. If you look back to Britain's relationship with the EU, we joined back in the 1970s when Britain was at a very low ebb in our relationship, in our economy. We were the sick man of Europe. We weren't doing so well. And we saw this as being an opportunity to join a free trade club. But that free trade club turned into something very different. It turned into a political union, which has taken a lot of control from the UK. We had a situation where 60% of laws in the UK were being made by Brussels. And people felt they wanted to take back control over lawmaking, have elected politicians in the UK making our laws rather than unelected politicians in Brussels. So, yes, I was slightly shocked in the sense that it was an awesome thing to do, but I knew that's where the public sentiment was.
Now that Brexit is underway, what sorts of things have to happen between now and the official break between Britain and the European Union?
Well, Prime Minister Theresa May has triggered Article 50 about 6 weeks ago. And that means there's a two-year negotiation to go through. Now, they suspect it will take a little bit quicker than that. It'll probably be done by about September 2018. Leaving about 3 months for the national parliaments and the European Parliament to actually ratify the final deal. So Britain would then leave on the new year of 2018-2019. And the negotiations will be, I think, actually relatively straightforward. We've got lots of hoo-ha in the press at the moment about, 100 billion euro bills that Britain will have to pay and how Britain has to be punished for daring to leave the EU. But actually, I think that when they get down to the details, as they will later this year, once the German elections are out of the way, I actually think it'd be relatively straightforward. The UK is the biggest export market for the rest of the EU. So why on earth wouldn't they want to do a free trade deal with the UK? Similarly, I don't think Theresa May will seek to punish the EU for Britain leaving. And I think she'd be willing to continue to give some money to the EU for a short period of time to help them in their transition to the sort of post-Brexit world as well. So the deal is there to be done.
You have suggested what might happen in relations between Britain and Europe. How about Britain and the US? What's likely to happen with Brexit?
Well, of course, Britain currently doesn't have a trade deal with the US because the US-EU trade deal, TTIP, collapsed and isn't going anywhere. So there isn't a trade deal at the moment. Yet, of course, we're still very reliant on each other, very overlapping in our economies. So, Britain is the biggest investor in the US economy, just like the US is the biggest investor in the UK economy. And if you're a Brit working for a foreign company, it's likely to be an American company. And if you're American working for a British company, for a foreign company, it's likely to be a British company. So there's a huge overlap between our two economies at the moment. So I hope that will be cemented and supplemented by having a free trade deal. And I was very pleased that Donald Trump talked about this, not only during his presidential bid, but also when Theresa May came to visit him in the White House shortly after his inauguration. And he's coming to the UK later in the year. He's coming in October. And I'm hoping that the US-UK trade deal will be the centerpiece of what they talk about.
Do you think that the fact that Donald Trump was such a supporter of Brexit and seems to have tapped into some of the same thoughts and attitudes that led to Brexit does help improve the chances that this relationship will remain and become even stronger?
I think it helps in a huge way. You may remember that during the referendum campaign itself, President Obama said that Britain would be sent to the back of the queue for a trade deal if it voted to leave. So to have a president who is actually supportive of Brexit and understands the motivations why people voted for it and wants to do a trade deal with the UK, I think can only be a good thing.
We are speaking with Matthew Elliott, senior fellow at the Legatum Institute in the UK. He was also CEO of the Vote Leave campaign that pushed for Brexit. Some people here in North Carolina are going to be hearing us and saying, well, I enjoy hearing that nice British accent, and this is kind of an interesting topic, but what does it really mean for me? If you were talking to an average North Carolinian and trying to tell them why Brexit is going to be good for them, what would you tell them?
I think for two reasons. First of all, did they know that $1.4 billion a year of exports go from North Carolina to the UK? And I hope that number will actually go up if we get this UK-US trade deal. I think secondly, another reason would be that I'm hoping that Brexit will be the first step in having wider worldwide free trade and greater prosperity from that. I actually think that Britain will be a guiding light in this. The EU is becoming more and more protectionist over the years, so not doing a trade deal with the US, for example, not being able to do a trade deal with China or with India, only doing a trade deal with Canada extremely slowly. So it's really become a regional protectionist trade bloc. And I think that if Britain leads the way in terms of being a sort of standard bearer for free trade in the EU, in Europe, then I think the rest of the EU will have to follow. And then I think we'll start to see other countries around the world starting to do trade deals again. Because things have really actually stalled in the trade world, really since the 1990s. And trade is the best way to improve worldwide prosperity. Not aid, not giving money to different countries, having trade deals with them.
As we're speaking, this is just in the aftermath of the French presidential election, and some are saying, wait a minute, the way that France voted is sort of against the tide of this populist movement that led to Brexit and to Donald Trump. I imagine that you see it a little bit differently.
I do. I mean, funnily enough, President Macron, the new president of France, had to reinvent himself politically. So he had been part of President Hollande's government as one of the finance ministers. He had to resign from that government about 2 years ago, set up a new political party, En Marche, to try and sort of show how he was in touch with the anti-establishment feeling and part of a new revolution to change France. So the fact he had to do that to me, was a win for populism in the sense that here's a politician who had to go against the grain of the status quo and the establishment. We'll have to see if he lives up to his rhetoric in the campaign. Like a lot of politicians, perhaps he'll go back on his promises and perhaps he'll go back to his roots as a socialist and an ENARC, graduate from France. But if he wants to stay popular, I think he has to realise, and he said this in his speech when he got the presidency, he's got to realise he's got to listen to the people who voted for Marine Le Pen.
Well, one person who's going to be watching all of these developments very closely is our guest, Matthew Elliott, senior fellow at the Legatum Institute. He was CEO of the Vote Leave campaign that pushed for Brexit. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One idea shot down by the North Carolina General Assembly this year, 4-year terms for state legislators. Republican Representative Harry Warren made the case for asking voters whether to extend the current 2-year terms into 4-year terms.
The only thing that changes if the voters approve would be the length of time that an elected official serves, which puts them in line with the other elected positions in Council of State, the Governor's Office, Lieutenant Governor. This would also serve to ensure a reasonable degree of institutional knowledge for our members as they serve in this capacity. As it currently stands, as you all know, being an elected official, we get sworn in January, run the short session, ideally till the end of June, sometimes a little later, but come the following February, you're filing to run again before the short session. And it's just an endless cycle of campaigning and fundraising. And I think the general public is tired of that, and I think it detracts from the proficiency and productivity of the legislature to be involved in politics or politicking and more than half the time that you're here to serve on behalf of the people. So this would also reduce the workload on local and state boards of elections. These bills have cropped up addressing our tenure 22 times since 1993. Every legislature before us has recognized the shortcomings of a two-year servitude here in this session.
Warren's idea ran into opposition from colleagues such as Republican John Blust. He cited the historical record supporting two-year terms for lawmakers.
The founders were very adamant that anybody with the power to levy taxes on fellow citizens needed to face those fellow citizens very frequently and every second year. The Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution says that House of Representatives shall consist of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states. And then later down in the same article, it said all bills to produce revenue must originate in that House that faces the voters very frequently. So I think this is one of the fundamental tenets of our very system of government, our republic, that those with the taxing power, those that can run tax bills, have to face the voters very frequently.
That's Republican State Representative John Blust, one of the lawmakers who helped kill an idea to extend state lawmakers' terms of service from 2 years to 4 years. The idea is dead for the rest of this legislative session. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some state lawmakers want to take steps to ensure greater protection of free speech on North Carolina public university campuses. Republican State Representative Jonathan Jordan recently explained the idea behind the Campus Free Speech Act.
In 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court stated, "The mere dissemination of ideas, no matter how offensive to good taste, on a state university campus may not be shut off in the name alone of conventions of decency."
Why is that relevant in North Carolina?
First of all, there are no statutes that address free speech at the constituent institutions of the University of North Carolina. The Board of Governors has adopted a broad policy that, quote, supports and encourages freedom of inquiry for faculty members and students, protects faculty and students, quote, in their responsible exercise of the freedom to teach, to learn, and otherwise seek and speak the truth. Within that framework, though, constituent university institutions may create their own policies that comply with the First Amendment.
What will Jordan's bill do?
It will require the Board of Governors at the University of North Carolina to develop, adopt, and implement various policies related to free expression.
Democrat Verla Insko of Orange County objected to Jordan's bill.
I would probably be fine with this bill if it stopped on page one, with the directing the Board of Governors to develop and adopt a policy for on free expression, that period there. This is a solution looking for a problem, really. I have followed the university system for a good many years. We have had some ups and downs with free speech, but we have ups and downs with everything. Young people come to college to learn about free speech, and they do it best through experience, not through a set of rules. So I don't like the sort of, we don't trust you, you're not grown up enough, you're not mature enough, you don't have the legal expertise. I don't like the sort of rule setting. I trust our campuses, they're professionals, they're more experienced than most of us in this sort of an issue, and I trust them to make those decisions and to communicate. I also don't like the committee, the reporting to that also you have to report to the world on how well you're doing. So we hear when things go wrong, we hear that in the newspaper. Sometimes these cases end up in court. That's where you deal with constitutional issues. I just don't like this kind of regulation of a constitutional right.
INSCO's opposition prompted a response from Republican Representative Chris Millis of Pender County.
Are you not aware that constituent institutions of the UNC system over the years, recently in fact, have been sued and have lost litigation against faculty members, where their free speech rights have been suppressed by administrative policies that have existed under the Board of Governors policy, and that these statutes are mostly needed to preempt that protection? And student groups as well have sued constituent institutions for the UNC system and have won, costing taxpayer dollars because these statutes were not on the books to protect both the students as well as the faculty. Are you aware that this may be a very good solution to a problem that most certainly exists, not just across the nation, but even here in North Carolina?
I believe the court system is exactly the place to solve these problems. That's where it needs to be done. And I think the world will survive best if we let the system work through the court system and through the institutions that are charged with helping our young people develop expertise through experience.
That's Democrat Verla INSCO responding to Republican Chris Millis during a state house debate about a bill dubbed the Campus Free Speech Act. Millis had another question for INSCO.
Is it not responsible for this body to, by way of our oversight of the Board of Governors and the UNC system, instead of having a student who may be enrolled in a university who their free speech rights are being suppressed, to have to litigate against the university that they are currently enrolled at, or a faculty member who is currently working at a constituent institution within our UNC system who may have to litigate against that institution, is it not better, is it not proper for us to have a set of proper regulations that may prevent those faculty members or those students from having their First Amendment rights violated in the first place?
I still agree that the courts are a public debate. The courts provide a public debate on these issues, and that's where I think that they're best handled.
Democrat Mickey Michaud of Durham blamed the bill on one conservative commentator.
This is sort of what you call the Ann Coulter bill, where Ann Coulter got into a big fuss and fight at one of our other universities, along with another gentleman, I can't pronounce his name, that people had a problem with them expressing their sentiments on a particular campus. By way of that, the university system in North Carolina has always had, basically, and because of litigation and whatnot, a policy of free speech on the campus. I call this a bill that regulates free speech. And that's exactly what it is, and I don't think that this body or any other body ought to be in the position of having to regulate free speech.
Bill sponsor Jonathan Jordan took issue with his Democratic colleague's assessment.
Regulating free speech, very interesting. Thank you for your comments, Representative Michaud. There's a campus right now in the University of North Carolina system that has free speech zones on campus. Those are the only places you can have free speech, the zones that the bureaucrats have set out for you. It's about 0.67% of the entire campus. I thought, when I went to college, as well as the two graduate schools that I've been to, that the entire university system was for free expression, not certain zones based on what a bureaucrat wanted. The Faculty Senate at Appalachian State University in February presented a statement on freedom of speech, and it sounds like it's pulled right out of our bill. They are very much in support of a free and open inquiry in all matters. Even if different members of the university community often and quite naturally conflict. But it is not the proper role of the university to attempt to shield individuals from ideas and opinions they find unwelcome, disagreeable, or even deeply offensive. This is just some of the statement from the Faculty Senate at Appalachian State. In case you're wondering if we need this bill besides about the free speech zones, our chancellor at Appalachian, who I have a very good relationship with, by the way, made this comment. It is important to note that free speech is encouraged on our campus, but not all speech that may be considered protected under state or federal laws is consistent with the university's values and mission. Speech protected by state and federal laws may not be consistent with our university's value and mission. Sounds like we need this bill very much on our campus to help provide some direction and some protection, not regulation of free speech. More free speech is good. I don't want to regulate the free speech. I want it to be available to all parties, left and right.
That's Republican State Representative Jonathan Jordan of Ashe County defending the Campus Free Speech Act. The House approved the idea with a vote of 88 to 32. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina's alcohol industry is a maze of rules and regulations that date back to Prohibition. But our next guest says that despite all of that, North Carolina distilleries are actually thriving. In his new book called Still and Barrel, John Trump traces the history of manufacturing moonshine, whiskey, gin, vodka, and rum. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks.
Now, your day job, we should let people know, is that you're actually managing editor of Carolina Journal.
Yes, I am.
But at night and on weekends, you have become an author writing this book. Why'd you write about it?
Well, what happened was my wife and I had gone on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail a couple years ago, and I was fascinated with the history, you know, the tradition, the sights and the smells. And I had gotten laid off from another job, so I had a lot of time on my hands. And my wife came home one day and threw this piece of a pamphlet at me. And she's like, you ought to check this out. And on the Bourbon Trail, there's a passport where you can visit the distilleries and check them off. And North Carolina had kind of the same thing, and I had never heard of this. I'm like, wow. So I started blogging about it, and I did a couple blogs. And I visit a distillery in Winston, Sutler's, which makes gin. And she's like – and I had done a blog, so I thought, well – and she persuaded me.
As wives can do, right?
That maybe if you're going to do this, you should try to get paid for it. So I had a lot of material already for a book proposal, and I submitted it to Blair. And they were excited about it, and they said – well, when can you have it done? And we talked about it a little bit. And I said, and it's being hot right now. And one of the impetuses behind his book was that people had written piecemeal about these distilleries, but nobody had actually put it together in a comprehensive you know, manual or book or guide or nonfiction narrative piece. So I said, well, okay, let's strike while the iron's hot, so to speak, and we could get this by September 1st. But
it's now been published, and it's called Still and Barrel, Craft Spirits in the Old North State, written by our guest, John Trump. Hey, John, I moved here from Arizona, and I was a NASCAR fan when I moved here. So my connection to North Carolina alcohol was really NASCAR and moonshiners. Is that part of the impetus here?
Well, right. I mean, NASCAR got its start from moonshiners, Junior Johnson outrunning the Revenuers. And that's true. That's how it happened. Some of the bigger bootleggers, the guys who transport it, you know, they were all, you know, the cat daddies. They were all, you know, see who could be faster, see who could outrun the law the best. And, you know, this is at a time when you can actually outrun the law, which technology is. I don't think you could do that anymore. But, you know, they'd have these friendly competitions or not so friendly and, you know, race each other. And that's kind of how, you know, they built North Wilkesboro, and NASCAR came from it. And NASCAR probably has separated itself from that moonshine heritage. But, I mean, Junior Johnson is the big one. And Willie Clay Call, for example, Buck Nance, guys at Wilkes County now who are just – Willie has died, but his sons, Brian Call, they do moonshine. It's the original recipe. It goes back 100 years in Wilkes County. So it's all from that tradition. He actually showed me a car. It was a New Yorker. I think a 60-something New Yorker.
A boat, a giant car.
A giant
right?
boat and where you could fit, I forget how many gallons of, you know, the plastic bottles of moonshine in the back.
And, wow.
He'd drive around town, you know, looking good, but no.
But you didn't know what was in the car.
Didn't know what was in the car. So yes, that's you know, the running is how NASCAR got started. But the moonshine tradition goes way back, of course.
Well, tell us about the industry today. You say it's thriving. I mean, how many distilleries are there? What do they make?
I guess thriving is a relative term. Some are doing well. Some are doing better than others. But, you know, it's an evolution. It's a process. You know, there's people who obviously they start off with the clear spirits, with the vodkas, with the moonshine, which isn't aged, with gin. Some people are very successful making gin. The sweet potato vodka, which has become – I mean, sweet potatoes, we're the biggest producer of sweet potatoes, I think, in the world, North Carolina is. And you know, that's another point. It plays off the agriculture because a lot of these distillers are – and as many as they can. One is even growing his own corn. You know, they get locally sourced wheat, Topo. In Chapel Hill gets wheat from Scott Linneck, a guy in Scott Linneck, who didn't know what to do with this red organic wheat. And Topo was like, huh, maybe we could make whiskey out of it. So that's how that starts, and it's evolved. So North Carolina agriculture, apples. There's a farmer in around the Wilkes County, Low Orchards, that supplies apples to Keith Norton at Carolina Distillery. So,
are these all products then that we would just buy in the store? I mean, are they selling to North Carolina? Do they sell outside the state or even outside the country?
The liquor itself,
uh-huh.
There's different strategies to that. You could be good for example, Muddy River in Belmont, which is around Charlotte, makes rum. It makes very good rum. But he doesn't go outside Mecklenburg County because you get to a point where you can't produce as much. Remember, these are small distillers. I mean, this isn't where they've got warehouses with 100,000 barrels in it. So they've got to kind of target it. Now, some bigger ones, quote unquote bigger, like Topo and Piedmont, have grown, Troy and Sons, where they'll sell outside the state. But I think the strategy now is you've got to be big in your community with shelf space. Because remember, in an ABC store, you're competing with Jim Beam, you're competing with Jack Daniels, you're competing with Crown Royal and Smirnoff and Bacardi. So the key is, you know, to find a way to get into these ABC stores and get people's attention. So I don't want to say you can't grow too quickly, but I think the idea now is to hit the neighborhoods, hit the base, build a following, and go from there.
What did you find when you started investigating some of these businesses? Are they in it because they love gin or they love rum, or are these entrepreneurs?
That's a great question. It's a little bit of both. I think with people like The Calls and Jeremy Norris and Benson, it's about legacy. Their descendants made it, a Howling Moon in Asheville. It goes back to the Scotch-Irish in western Pennsylvania. So, you know, it's a legacy. It's a tradition. Remember, I mean, we didn't allow alcohol to be made in North Carolina until 1979, and we didn't get the first distiller here until 2005. So it's a nod to that legacy tradition. And now they said, well, we can do this. A big impetus was a lot of people were buying it in Tennessee, for example. Some of the bigger makers were buying it in Indiana, a mass-produced commodity, alcohol, just plain alcohol. You could buy it as a commodity. And they're like, this tastes like vodka. This is awful. We got to make our own. And a lot of this is entrepreneurship and a passion, a desire to succeed and do something special.
Well, it's a really interesting new book. It's been written by our guest, John Trump. And by the way, no relation to the president. He is actually managing editor of Carolina Journal. The book is called Still and Barrel, Craft Spirits in the Old North State. John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, great.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.